Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Women's History via the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Davis. Today, we will be speaking with Professor Honoré Fanon Jeffers, poet and professor of English at the University of Oklahoma. We're going to chat with her about her recent publication, just came out in March 2020, a volume of poetry entitled The Age of Phyllis, which portrays the life and times of Phyllis Wheatley Peters with careful attention to the archival record. Professor Honoré Jeffers, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. And please feel free to call me Honoré.
I will do that. Thank you. Would you mind starting us off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I've been a publishing poet for 23 years. My first poem was published in 1997. My first book was published in 2020. And I've been what most people would call a confessional poet, which means that I tend to write about myself. But over the past now 16 years, I began to be very interested in the archives, in the historical archives, and the lives of early African Americans. And so that's how I got involved in this long but wonderful process in writing about Phyllis Wheatley Peters.
Oh, great. Could you tell us just a little bit about how you came to this particular project?
Well, in 2003, I've been at University of Oklahoma since 2002. I'm a deep Southerner, and you probably can tell that from my voice. And I came to Oklahoma for the job. But I've always been really interested in history, particularly early African American history, but it never really was focused, I should say. So I would just sort of, you know, encounter random things. I, you know, start reading about them and you know, that's just kind of how I did things. But in 2003, I read an article in The New Yorker by the great Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. Mm-hmm. Of Harvard University. And he was talking about who I then knew as Phyllis Wheatley. And the implications of African Americans in the Enlightenment period, how Black people, Africans, and in Africa and on this side of the water, and how they were viewed by philosophers of the Enlightenment period. And he had included Thomas Jefferson in there. Mm-hmm. And I had never really known, you know, it was kind of well known in Black circles, even not even in academic circles, but just Black circles, that Thomas Jefferson had sired, as it were, right. children with Sally Hemings. But I had not known his very ugly attitudes about people of African descent. And so until I encountered this essay in The New Yorker, and I had not known his ugly attitudes towards Phyllis Wheatley at that time. That's how I knew her. And so I just began to be very fascinated. I reread the article, and then it just sent me on a reading jag. And I began to read other books. One in particular that was very, very important to me is Catherine Clay Bassard's Spiritual Interrogations, Culture, Gender, and Community in Early African American Women's Writing. That was just, and what she did was she talked about the child who would be renamed Phyllis Wheatley and her Middle Passage journey.
Right.
And that sort of opened up a lot for me.
And that really opens up the book, right? The poems that really help us to kind of enter into that world. That's really, really remarkable.
Because one of the things that I want people to know is that Phyllis Wheatley did not arrive in Boston in 1761. A trafficked African child whose name is now lost to the historical record arrived in Boston.
Right. Let's pick up with that in just a minute. I actually want to begin not at the beginning, but if we could begin at the end. Your volume concludes with an essay considering your sources, introducing the research that you've done. It's an essay of 20 pages and 51 footnotes. So as a historian, I looked at that.
You counted.
I looked at it, man. And I thought this was really
Chicago too. In Chicago
format.
Chicago is the bane of my existence. It was so hard.
For a reader, that is just, I mean, that is gold. I really admired the level of scholarship. And I wondered if you could share a little bit with us about your research and your writing process for this book.
Well, this essay is really a revised, very much revised, but it is a revised essay that I wrote for a non-academic audience. That was published in a anthology called The Fire This Time. I think it's a new generation of African Americans write about race. I don't know how new I was because I was I was in my late 40s. So, but that was flattering. And so I had been asked to write this essay for lay people, as it were. And the essay was really about the way that people had considered not only Phyllis Wheatley Peters, but her husband, and how it was the gaps in the research and then some outright lies on John Peters that had actually led me to decide that I was going to write a book on Phyllis Wheatley Peters. Because I said, you know, it was clear that people weren't really Except for, again, Catherine Clay Bassard, a couple of other poets, June Jordan, and Robert Hayton, people weren't really looking at her as a person who loved, who had lost, who had gone through trauma. Again, with exception of those people, they were basically using her as a prop to move ideas about the time around. And, I didn't like that. And so, one of the things that I found out when I was at the American Antiquarian Society, I had a Barron Artist Fellowship back in 2009, the summer of 2009. And, I had a mentor, Caroline Sloat, who was then, working, as a researcher for the American Antiquarian Society. She's since now retired. And she was my mentor. And she really looked beyond my being a poet, right? And there were other people there, people who were there on the, you know, research scholarships, the scholarly scholarships, as it were, who looked at me as more than a poet. And I encountered some other people who would, whenever they would, you know, despite the research discoveries that I shared with people, there were a few people who would introduce me to others and say, Honoré's a poet. That's what they would never say. Honoré's a poet who has discovered X, Y, and Z, or I would say encountered, because, you know, you don't discover it. It's always been there. I'll go on ahead.
But to put the pieces together, right, that mm-hmm. can be a real gift to the scholarly community to say, these pieces, if we put them together in this way, actually requires us to rethink what we've assumed.
It requires us to rethink, and it requires us to look at the history in a different way.
Right.
And so I guess it was about halfway through when Miss Caroline, that's what I called her. She hated when I called her Miss Caroline, but she, you know, she was older than I was, and I'm from the Deep South, and, you know, I'm just not raised to be calling older people, you know, by their first name. And that's very, you know, that's something very African diasporic as well. We really do have elder reverence in African American communities as well as African communities. So Miss Caroline had told me, she said, you know, you need to go to Waltham, to the Northeast National Archives in Waltham, Massachusetts. And I really didn't want to, because she was talking about microfiche. You know, when I'm cooking something, my nemesis is whipped egg whites. And when I'm doing research, my nemesis is microfiche.
Oh, same.
It really makes me nauseated, like the way that you have to, right? And so I was like, Miss Caroline, I don't like microfiche. And she said, do you want to be an historian or not? Right. So, you know, I didn't want to disappoint her.
Right.
So I got my little, you know, 2001 at that time. I love that car like a child, Pontiac Sunfire. And I put it in the road, and, I drove to Waltham. I actually drove up and down the Eastern Seaboard during that month. I went to Newport, Rhode Island. I went to Salem, Massachusetts, to the Peabody Museum. I went everywhere. I went to Boston. I went everywhere. And so when I got to Waltham, and I was, you know, on that microfiche and, you know, sort of swallowing my nausea, I saw John Peter's name on the 1790 census. and which is the Boston census, Suffolk County. And I went back and forth, and I went back and forth looking for another John Peters or looking for another Negro John Peters.
Right.
There was only one John Peters on the entire census. And this was confusing to me because in the biography that we attribute to Margaretta Matilda Odale, memoir and poems of Phyllis Wheatley, she or whoever, you know, wrote the memoir, because it's published anonymously, said that John Peters had moved further south after the death of his wife. So that was really confusing.
Right.
And so, you know, I took pictures of the, you know, I bought my little digital camera. I bought my camera while I was there in Massachusetts. I noticed that everybody else had their little digital camera. So I took pictures, you know, with my digital camera of the pages. And then I drove back to Worcester, which is where the American Antiquarian Society is. And the next day, at lunch, which was when all of the fellows would meet with Miss Caroline, I told her about what had happened. And she had already begun to nudge me toward writing a book.
Right.
Okay. Of poetry. Because I had read some of my poems that had previously been written before I had come to Worcester. And one of them was about Susanna Wheatley and the three children that she had lost when the children were in very early childhood. Mm-hmm. And I had discussed, you know, my in-progress research at that time about the fact that the little girl who would be renamed Phyllis Wheatley was around the same age as Sarah Wheatley, Susanna and John Wheatley's child. She was around that same age. Phyllis was when the little girl had died.
Oh.
They had on the grave her exact age. And I noticed that other whites in Massachusetts would do that. They would have the exact age of their child, right? And so Sarah was 7 years, 9 months, and 18 days.
Oh my word.
And that began to make sense, right?
Right.
That so there were things in the biography that we attribute to Odale that did sort of line up. Right. So the fact that Miss Phyllis the little girl would have been around the age where she would have lost her two front teeth. Right.
Yeah.
And that Susanna Wheatley had lost three children in childhood. So there were things that had lined up. Right. But there were other things that did not. And so when I told Miss Caroline about the fact that I had seen John Peters' name, it was you know, near Bedlam, as Bedlam as you can get with a group of historians.
Right.
And they were like, "Are you kidding, Honoré?" I said, "Yes, I saw it. I took pictures." And they were like, "Oh, wow." You know, so all of my crew, right, who was there, Tanya Mears, Meredith Newman, Jonathan Senshin, and Emily Pauly. Paul Erickson was then director of academic programs, so he didn't have lunch with us, right?
Right.
But he's also part of that crew from that year. Sure. So the four who were at lunch were, I mean, it was really something. And that was the moment when I realized that, I hesitate to use the word just, because I think that art brings something to history in the same way that history brings something to art. So I don't want to say in that moment I realized I wasn't just a poet, but I will say in that moment I realized, in addition to being a poet, that I was on the road to becoming a scholar. And it was something that kind of hit me with a thunderclap. So I saw that. And then, I saw a couple of other things. And so then when I wrote the essay for The Fire This Time, which includes very well-known African-American creative writers, and then I always say, and me, because I don't really, have the reputation of Kevin Young, who's now, the director of the Schomburg, or, Jesmyne Ward, who's the only African-American woman, or at might be only African-American to have won two national book awards. But she's definitely the only, but at that time she had won one, right? That was still pretty much a big deal. But I wrote about racism. The racism that I encountered in the Odell memoir, the memoir that's attributed to Odell.
Right.
And then 3 years later, when I was finally finishing up the book of poetry, which, had taken me, 15 years of research, I was doing... what I do whenever I finish a book, obsessively reading for mistakes, checking, all of that, which was, of course, more complicated, given that this had a scholarly afterword and then notes and all of that.
Right.
And I went back to do last minute research, which, you can do some or archival research, obviously not if you're, really doing a deep dive, but there are some archival sources that are now available online.
Sure.
So I went back and I looked up the Odell memoir, which I had sort of thrown out there because no one had ever done a genealogy, not a real genealogy on Odell. They had simply said in a footnote in the proceedings of the Massachusetts Historical Society, well, yeah, we know that she's related to Susanna Wheatley through da 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 da. And that was it. We had never received a genealogy at that point. We now have one. But I know that there wouldn't have, I try not to be arrogant in the field of history, right? But I do not believe that we would have ever received a genealogy on Margaretta Matilda Odell had I not, thrown down a gauntlet.
Right.
About the problems that I saw. And so then when I was doing the final, sort of pass through on the manuscript, and I looked up the Odell memoir, I saw another memoir by Benjamin Bussey Thatcher. And I had noticed that I had seen sort of like a cursory mention of him. I think it was in the John Shields, one of the John Shields books on Miss Phyllis, and I had ignored it. Which, to my own detriment, I had ignored that Benjamin Bussey Thatcher had written a memoir. And so when I went and I saw the Thatcher memoir, which was also on that North Carolina University of North Carolina, the Documenting the American South.
Oh, sure.
I saw his memoir and it was nearly identical. And I thought, somebody plagiarized.
Right.
But which one? And that's as far as I got then. You know, I've done some more research. I mean, we can talk about it if you want to, but that was as far as I got. But I knew something was fishy. And then I also noticed, and this is one of the things, you know, that I want to get more formal training as an historian, because the details, I had ignored those details. And the other detail was that Odell's name never appeared on the memoir.
Right.
It was right. Anonymously. Thatcher's name appeared on his memoir. Right. But in the ad, there's no name for the memoir that is supposed to be written by a Wheatley relative. Right. And so I thought, well, how did Odell's name get attached? And again, it got attached because of a footnote that no one had, you know, no one really has done still. Yeah. Any kind of research on, you know, I mean, nobody has found the smoking gun, as it were. They haven't found a manuscript. They haven't found the printer's records. They haven't whatever. So at this point, right. I just whenever I refer to it, I say the supposed Odell memoir, or, you know, in print, I put in brackets and then question mark after right. Odell's name, which really annoys some people, but, you know. It is what it is.
I mean, that's the historical process, right? If you're if you're not saying, how do you know this? That's
well, it is, Jennifer. How do you know this?
Right.
You know, I don't. And I think that particularly what is annoying me as an African American woman is the fact that people are not really doing the due diligence around this that they would if this was a white woman mm-hmm. or a white man. And I've talked about that, right? That's very distressing to me,
right?
That people just assume, well, you know, somebody said that John Peters was janky and trifling and wouldn't work, and, you know, and they were white, so there you go.
Well, and even worse, that there's an assumption that there won't be records, that we can't know that. And so you mm-hmm. allow that kind mm-hmm. of laziness to kick in when we have mm-hmm. entire fields dedicated to recovering the evidence for folks who maybe don't leave as many personal archives, right?
Exactly. That's a really good point. And, you know, the whole thing about John Peters and there have been some people who sort of, you know, made fun of him or, you know, or nearly made fun of him when they talk about the fact that he was a lawyer, mm-hmm. okay? And that, you know, he was suing people who owed him money. But what a lot of people don't know who have not also done research on early Africa mm-hmm. is that when we look at Mungo Park's narrative, and of course, you know, Mungo Park was a white British man, you know, who brought his own white supremacist ideology and racism to the continent. But when Mungo Park wrote about the Gambia in his narrative of the late 18th century, he talked about how there were, in the villages, there were courts.
Right.
In villages. And that there were Muslim clerics, okay? There were Muslim barristers, rather, not clerics. There were, you know, lawyers.
Right.
Who would represent people in these African villages. So I do think that the missing link is that we have to have more people who are, you know, not just looking at issues like art and, you know, foodways and that kind of stuff, but who are also looking at other aspects of African life. Not that food ways aren't incredibly important, right?
Right.
But that draw connections between what Africans were doing in the 18th century and what Blacks in America who were not, you know, who were still Africans, right? And what they were doing. And so, and also the other thing is that people want to talk about, you know, how nice the Wheatleys were for teaching the little girl how to read and write. And I think, you know, yes, it's nice, but I also think that this is what you're supposed to do with children. And you're supposed to be nice to children. That shouldn't be a miraculous thing.
Right.
Right. Just because that's a little Black girl doesn't mean that it's miraculous. Right. You know, people are that's human nature. Right. But that little Muslim girls were also taught to read the Quran and to write.
Right.
And so there is that legacy, that heritage. And I think that we need to begin to consider the African part of not just her life, but John Peter's life when we begin to sort of construct a way of looking at her.
And that, I think, helps us bring that into American history, ideally.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Through
mm-hmm.
those individuals, mm-hmm. we begin to say, it's not just one individual. This is a bigger set of systems, right? That arrives in the North American continent that really changes the course of every society, Native American, European, uh-huh. and African societies that run against each other here. So it was just announced that the Age of Phyllis will be the common read of the Society of Early Americanists in 2021. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I cried like a fool when I was so shocked and so happy, you know, and so honored, work that I had done, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to start crying. because I've been crying off and on since, you know, they let me know, you know.
I think it's just wonderful news for the society, mm-hmm. for all of the folks who will get a chance to read this. You'll also be one of the keynote speakers at that conference, right?
I'll be giving a plenary reading.
A plenary.
From the book.
Great.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah, whatever that means, right? I'll be giving, you know, that's a nice little fancy term. I will have on a cute outfit.
Excellent.
I'll be giving that reading. And then there'll be a colloquium with college and university professors and students.
Great.
And I love that. I love working with the young folk and sort of breaking down concepts and ideas into manageable bits. That's what I do. And I love that with the young people to interact with them. And the other reason I love it is because their professors have been trying to get them to look at particular concepts and ideas as important.
Right.
And, you know, there's a place in the Bible, I forgot which verse it is, but it talks about a prophet is never, you know, appreciated, never honored in his own land.
Right.
So I noticed that myself. It's not until a visitor comes in and a visitor says, this is important.
Right.
And then my students will look at me like, yeah, Professor Jeffers, you tried to tell us. And I'm like, I tried to tell you. So I love, you know, being able to meet with the kids and to reinforce what their own professors have spoken about. That's one of the great joys of when I you know, do visits and that kind of stuff. So, yes. And then I'll be on a featured panel as well, talking about Phyllis Wheatley Peters.
Great. Oh,
so lots of work.
Yes.
I'm pretty excited. Yes.
Well, congratulations. And I think with that, why don't we move to a reading of a poem or two?
Okay. So I'm going to read from Mothering Number One and Mothering Number Two.
Great.
Is that all right?
Sounds wonderful.
Okay. So let me just give a little background. So Mothering Number One is from the section of the book that begins the book with the child, who I call Gune. And Gune simply means, you know, little child.
Mm-hmm.
In like, you know, baby child or baby girl, you know, something like that in the Wolof language of the Senegambia region, right? And Miss Phyllis, when she began reading poetry, writing poetry rather, identified herself as from being from the Gambia. So I imagined this. I imagined her also as an African Muslim, since the Gambia was a Muslim region. And so this is Mothering Number One. This is the day that this child is born. The other thing is Yai means mother in the Wolof language. Mothering Number One. Yai, someplace in the Gambia, circa 1753. After the afterbirth is delivered, the mother stops holding her breath. The midwife gives what came before her, just wash pain, her insanity pain and undeserved pain, God-giving pain, oh, pain, drum-talking pain, witnessing pain. Allah, a mother offers you this gift, praise you find it acceptable, her living pain, her creature pain, her pretty little baby pain. The second poem occurs after the little girl, the child, has survived the horrific Middle Passage in a slave ship across the Atlantic Ocean. And I imagine that it is Susanna Wheatley, who is the wife of a prosperous Boston merchant, who purchases a little girl, a little African girl, at the harbor that day in summer 1761. This is Mothering Number Two. Susanna Wheatley, Boston Harbor, summer 1761. And so, because the little girl was bony and frail, Mistress Wheatley gained her for a trifling, passing by the other slaves from the brig called Phyllis. The white woman's mind, muddled by what the light revealed, a seven-year-old, naked, dark body, there for every sailor to lay his shameless eyes upon, a child, the age of her dead little girl. I'm trying to both see and discard that day. As when I stood over the open casket of an old man, counting the lines on his face, grieving yet perverse, refusing to believe that hours from then he'd be cranked down into the grave. And so the lady tarried in front of the sickly child, distracted by the gulls screaming at port, their shadows dogging the constant sea. They were drawn by the stink of a slave ship, by lice in unwashed heads of hair. And so she bought that child, not someone older with muscles, strong enough to carry a servant's burden. That was the moment, a humming, epic page, that one, in the carriage, a mothering gesture, finger beneath a chin, lifting the face up to trust the fickle air between them, almost love. She took the child into her home, fed and bathed her, deciphered the naps on her head, dressed her in strange garments, gratitude and slavery. And so,
thank you so much. I think these two poems for me really, these were what hooked me. I could not put the book down after those two really sunk into me, both the love and power of a connection that you so quickly establish between this family in Africa and how their world is blown apart. This child's world is blown apart and she has to take the pieces and put something together as after she's trafficked across the ocean. I want to thank you so much for that gift of the real solidity, the emotional solidity that you've really created around this historical individual, but you make her so compelling to me that now I've got this reading jag where I have to read everything Phyllis Wheatley has written. I just, I'm tearing up here.
I am too. It's okay. Oh, I mean, I think about it. I think about that little girl the grown woman that was Phyllis Wheatley Peters mothered me across the centuries.
Yeah.
You know, she made this space possible for me. And not just as a poet, as an intellectual, as an academic, you know, she gave this gift to me and I wanted to give this gift back to her, you know, to do what nobody had ever done, to acknowledge her parents.
Right.
Right? People have erased those people, you know, and she never did. I mean, she has that poem where she, you know, the poem that's to the right, to William, the right Earl of Dartmouth. And
yes.
She says, you know, What pangs excruciating must molest? What sorrows labor in my parents' breast? So she never forgot those people, but we forgot them. And it wasn't, you know, I forgot them until, you know, I began to think about it. And I do, you know, I mean, I know one of the things about being an academic is you're not supposed to talk about mysticism or spirituality, but I am an Africana mystic. And I do believe that I was chosen to do this work, as others have been chosen to do the work of going into the archives. And I mean, we're all chosen in different ways. I don't think I'm any more special than anybody else, but this was my charge.
Right. Right.
You know, yes. So I do, I tear up and I'm going to tear up. You know, I always bring a handkerchief with me. I'm going to tear up when I read, you know, the Society of Early Americanists. That probably be the first time they ever see somebody who's a scholar, you know, start crying on stage, but it is what it is. It's a new day.
It's heavy stuff. I mean, if you're not willing to really get in there.
Right. And if I don't cry while I'm writing it, how can I expect somebody else to feel something?
Right.
You know, if I don't feel it, how can I expect somebody else to feel it?
Yeah.
And I'm not done, you know, with Miss Phyllis.
Oh, you know, good.
I'm not done. I have essays, you know, and then somebody's going to find something. And that is, I think, the biggest thing is I want people to go back to the archives. Mm-hmm. Because as one of my good friends, Jonathan Senchin, said to me, he does print culture, African-American print culture. And he said to me, that second manuscript that was never published, that's got to be floating around someplace.
Yeah. Somebody has that in an attic.
Somebody has that in their attic or in a, somebody's got it. Just like, you know, historians used to say that Africans had no literature. And then they found all of those manuscripts buried in that African librarian's backyard.
Right?
Somebody's keeping it. And it's not just about her, but the more we learn about her, the more we learn about African Americans, what they brought. And we don't just look at them as victims, which is one of the reasons that, you know, I wrote the section on Black male participation in the American Revolution.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's such a great section.
I just I think about it and I'm like, how come nobody's ever made a movie about this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be, you know, one of those swashbuckling, you know, movies that they make for cisgender heterosexual men, you know what I mean? Lots of people getting killed, but you know, all of that, you know, and then I look at Olato Equiano. I mean, whether or not he was born in South Carolina, right? But when you look at his narrative and it, you know, so much takes place on the sea.
Oh yeah.
And there are pirates. And I'm like, you know, let's open our idea of what enslaved life was, you know, instead of, you know, a fake Negro spiritual, right? I get so tired of those fake Negro spirituals, right? And you're like, we just didn't have those in the 18th century. Can we, you know, change that, right? But, you know, this is really exciting. And when you think about her life and all that she lived, all of those eras, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, certainly it's tragic that she died around the age of 30 or 31. But when you think about all that she experienced, the good and the bad, I mean, she experienced what somebody that was 85 or 90 years old, like there was so much happening and, you know, so much going on. And, I just find her fascinating and wonderful, you know.
I think you help everybody see how fascinating of a character she is and what a talented poet and what tremendous work she does moving between cultures and really uniting them in her poetry. I have one last question for you because I think, unfortunately, we're almost out of time.
I talk a lot.
Great stuff, right? So what are you working on now, Honoré? What's your next big project?
Well, okay. So right now I'm waiting on edits on a novel that is under contract with Harper, which is one of the umbrella companies with HarperCollins. So this is my, you know, sort of my first, national thing where I'm hoping a lot of people will read. Not very many people read poetry. So that's why I've just been really excited about, you know, people reading The Age of Phyllis. So that novel, If God Says the Same, will be coming out in May 2021. And it's called The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. And it's a coming of age story about a young African-American woman whose family is in the South. And then I am beginning to nibble around the edges of an essay collection, personal essays that interrogate and intersect with early African and early African American history and my own family history. And it's always really scary when you start a new project. You feel kind of goofy and, you know, who's going to read this? But that's what I'm doing. And at least one of those essays will be about Miss Phyllis. So again, I'm not done with her. I think she's just, you know, going to be with me forever. And
oh, wonderful.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I hope that everybody can kind of take a minute to check out the book. We'll provide a link on the podcast, and I hope that we can talk again soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Jennifer. I really appreciate you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.